Women's Protection and Empowerment Podcast, where we give space to talking about women and girls in humanitarian settings. I'm Christy Crabtree. We're in the midst of the largest humanitarian crisis in the last 50 years. 20 million people are at risk of starvation and famine in Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan, and Yemen. And the effects of this are severe malnutrition and mortality. But it goes further than that, affecting economic development and outputs for years to come as well. I'm joined by two colleagues, Patty Gray, the Emergency Response Team Women's Protection and Empowerment Coordinator, who was recently in Yemen and Nigeria, two of the countries impacted by the crisis, and Janine Cawson, the Senior Policy and Advocacy Officer for Women's Protection and Empowerment. Welcome back, both.
Thanks, Christy. Happy to be here.
Thanks, Christy.
Janine, I understand a lot of funding for the famine is guided towards supporting critical nutrition and health needs, but how does the famine uniquely affect women and girls?
This is a really great question. Thanks, Christy. I think exactly as you point out, a lot of the attention has really been focused on nutrition and water and sanitation and health. But even within those sectors, there's very specific impacts on women and girls that are often being overlooked. If you look at just nutrition, pregnant and lactating women are at heightened risk of malnutrition. And even in South Sudan, there's 1 in 4 pregnant and lactating women are malnourished. So that's a very clear indication of how nutrition and famine and food insecurity are impacting women. But it's also more about gender norms that also are dictating that often women and girls are the last to eat. So you also see a huge impact in terms of households that are headed by females who are at heightened risk of food insecurity because they have less access to food and they're also willing to sacrifice their own nutrition in order to provide for their children. And in particular in Yemen, there are 20 to 30% of households are headed by females. And so they also have mobility restrictions that are impacting their ability to access food. If you look at water and sanitation as well, in each of these four contexts you mentioned, lack of clean water is leading to outbreaks of waterborne diseases, including cholera. And we do know that women and girls often take on an additional burden of caring for ill family members who are suffering from waterborne diseases. So that's impacting their ability to do other things that they would have been doing prior to the onset of food insecurity and famine. But it's also adding additionally to their burden as they do the lion's share of labor around collecting water and food and firewood. And so as these resources are becoming more and more scarce as a result of the drought, they're having to travel further and further away from their families and communities in search of these resources, which of course exposes them to further risk of gender-based violence along the way, particularly sexual harassment and assault, including rape. And we've seen it, and I think Patty could probably speak to this more from her experience on the ground, but in some places in South Sudan, women and girls are walking 3 to 4 hours each way to access water. And Somalia, it's the same. In some places, they're traveling 125 kilometers just to get water. And then, as I mentioned, not only by traveling further and further away are they increasing their susceptibility to gender-based violence, but gender-based violence predated the food insecurity and famine in each of these countries. And so it's being further exacerbated by the drought and food insecurity. So, you know, we've seen really startling statistics over the past year in several countries. And South Sudan, when the food crisis was just beginning to unfold last year, we saw a staggering increase of about 61% of gender-based violence incidents being reported. And even when we look at, there's now been over 1 million South Sudanese who have fled South Sudan into Uganda, and over 86% of them are women and children. And they have cited the fact of increased susceptibility to gender-based violence as one of the main reasons that they've been fleeing for safety in Uganda. And also in terms of Somalia, there was a drought in 2011. And one big impact that we saw there that's being replicated again this time is an increase in negative coping mechanisms, particularly around child early and forced marriage. And back in the 2011 famine in Somalia, families were marrying their daughters off as young as 9 in order to pay their dowries in kind before their livestock perished as a result of the famine and the drought. And so as children are being forced into marriage, they often are taken out of school. And so this is having lifelong implications for them. It's also, again, increasing their susceptibility to other protection risks. as well. So I think those are some of the pieces that are not being discussed as frequently as we'd like to see. And really, they are exacerbating already these pre-existing susceptibility to gender-based violence.
Patty, you just returned from Yemen and Nigeria. Can you share any stories from the field that speak to this impact on women and girls?
I was actually thinking about Nigeria as Janine was speaking. I should say I was there a year ago, so I'm not quite just back from there. So one thing that struck me as we were trying to provide response services in Nigeria was actually the lack of gender-based violence and reproductive health services. I remember everywhere where we were going to do assessments, a lot of those services hadn't even started yet. And the crisis actually started around 2012 and long predated the famine. Famine was actually happening because of the conflict setting. What's a shame throughout the famine is that that's being forgotten. And so it's critical that we provide the nutrition services, but not to forget that we're there because there was conflict pre-existing in a lot of the areas where we're intervening and that the protection services are still needed. So for instance, in Nigeria, we went up to a place called Monguno, and it was just shocking and startling how there were little to no reproductive health services. The hospital had said two or three pregnant women had passed away within the past few months. And then they said, but we don't need to worry because no women are coming to the hospital anyway. So obviously they don't need services. But then when we spoke to the woman, it was obvious that the reason they weren't going to the services is because they were either harassed at checkpoints, but had to find then extra money to go to the hospital, which meant then their children wouldn't be fed because there already is food insecurity, there's economic insecurity. And so all of these factors weren't being taken into consideration. A lot of the NGO medical services as well were providing a response to the malnutrition crisis, but then not to the other crisis factors that were existing as well. And so it was quite harrowing to see how everything had shifted as the food insecurity became more critical, but then without thinking about those other services that are still needed.
It really has quite a wide ripple effect off of that, starting before and then getting worse after food insecurity or famine's happening. Why do you see it as really urgent that programming address women and girls' needs?
One is they are the majority of the population. It's critical to address the needs of women and girls or to understand the special circumstances that they're in. Because each year that we neglect women and girls, the gap that they face becomes larger and larger. So, for instance, in Nigeria, when we went there, we found a lot of times that adolescent girls weren't allowed to access any of the services or had extreme fear. And so what had happened, I know the Chibok girls are quite well known, but then there were also other women and girls who had been abducted and then returned. And so they faced the extra level of not being able to seek services. They were forced to stay at home and they weren't allowed to have their lives anymore, basically because the community was afraid of them. And so that means there's this whole group of people within the community that now, because we're not addressing it as NGOs are trying to engage in that dialogue, that is being forgotten and quite frankly being very hidden. And these are now the women and girls who are, or the girls at least, who are growing up in those communities and are meant to be leaders later on and participate in their community and provide economic well-being to the community. In Yemen, a lot of people are starting to enter because of the famine, but again, there was a pre-existing crisis. And there, it was quite shocking to hear staff talk about how much women's rights have curbed in the past 3 years. And I know a lot of the female staff as well were quite worried that this is what their daughters were going to grow up with and see. And therefore, while a lot of the adult women are part of civil society, they engage in civil society, they engage in activism, they're educated, they were all quite worried that their daughters aren't going to see the same strength in women because education is curbed, because we're not putting those resources towards saying gender-based violence is wrong. We're not responding in the same way. And throughout all these crises, as we shift for a nutrition crisis, I see the space for women and girls being taken away just so that they can simply thrive. So, and something I think that's important that the women centers do is that they provide that space for women not just to think and do recreational activities and even get educational activities. It's about filling that gap. This is a bit random. So I was reading Trevor Noah's book recently. And so he was talking about if you give a man a fish, he eats for a day. If you teach a man to fish, he eats for a lifetime. And he was saying, but the thing that people forget is that that man still needs a fishing pole to fish. You can't just teach somebody to fish. They actually need the input as well.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking about it in the women centers, and it's not that women don't even have the skill set, but they need that initial input because it's been taken away from them. So some of it is about filling that gap so they can have that input again.
Absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense, actually. So on that note, what is IRC doing about this? What are we doing to address women and girls' needs in famine and food insecure settings?
So in famine and food insecure settings, something that's quite unique in Yemen that's being done is that we have two approaches. We have the women's protection empowerment approach. We set up safe spaces where women can go in and access the women's centers. So in Yemen, they're called Laki centers, which mean for her in Arabic, although I may have just very much incorrectly said the Arabic word. So we have that. So right now, both Nigeria and Yemen, there's also huge cholera outbreaks as a result of downward spiral. If you have famine and people are food insecure and there's no safe water sources, and then usually cholera does come eventually. So they're able to access the center and get information from trained female personnel who can explain how to reduce the effects of cholera. They're getting skills training so that they can start at least doing some economic well-being, which can help reduce some of the negative coping strategies I hate calling it negative coping strategy because sometimes it's the only coping strategy you have. You're going to want to feed your family, but to help reduce some of the need for negative coping strategies. And then also in Yemen, what they have is gender advisors. This is quite critical as well, because what the gender advisors do is actually work with the nutrition teams, the economic relief teams, and the water and sanitation to help make sure that from beginning to end, women can access the services. Because what we find in a lot of crisis scenarios, not just even the food insecurity and nutrition crises, is that women can't even access the services. So they're making sure that women can access from beginning to end. And they're also trying to make sure that females are involved from beginning to end so that they know where they can actually pick up the food. They know where they can get vouchers for food relief, and that they know which vendors are safe to work with, who will make sure that woman can actually access the relief items that they need.
I imagine there's also some kind of funding crisis involved with this as well. Is this being funded adequately, or what are the gaps there?
Patty mentions these conditions are in large part a consequence of protection issues, and they're being further exacerbating the protection risks. And so even before the current food crisis came onto the scene, protection programming was insufficient to meet the needs of the populations affected. And so now that you're seeing more and more people are being displaced and seeking food and safety elsewhere, it's creating additional demands on an already overstretched response, which is, again, resulting in increased protection risks. And so this is one of the key reasons that we've been doing a lot of advocacy to make sure that in the famine and food insecurity responses that we are paying particular attention to protection. But even if we look at overarching humanitarian response in each of the four countries, it's the response itself is underfunded. And it really ranges from the low end. It's about, in Yemen, about 42% of the total funding needed to respond across all of the sectors. Only 42% is already funded. And it goes all the way up to about 65% funded in South Sudan. And Somalia and Nigeria are somewhere in between, around a little less than half of the funding is in place. Again, and that's for the overall response, every single sector that is needed to address issues from nutrition and food and health and shelter and protection. But what's important to note is that the protection sector is almost always the least funded of all the sectors. And particularly in an instance like this, where we think of first phase response for a famine might be the things that we've already talked about, nutrition and health and water and sanitation, and then we'll get to the other issues. When we dig a little bit deeper and we see protection, it's really, really underfunded. So we only have about 15% of the funding we need for protection programming in South Sudan. And again, that's not just gender-based violence, that's all of protection. So looking at protection rule of law, looking at child protection and gender-based violence, all of that is only getting 15% of the funding that's needed to meet needs. The same for Somalia, it's also about 15%. And it's not much better in Yemen, it's about 23% funded for protection programming, and Nigeria, it's about 27% funded. So we're seeing drastic underfunded appeals in each of these countries. And then when you dig the layers back a little deeper, you're seeing even starker underfunding in particular areas that Patty and I have been talking about.
What can be done about this on the policy side? I mean, 15 to 23%, that's a ridiculous percentage. Is there advocacy going on to change policies?
That's a great question. Thanks, Christy. There is. I think there's a lot of advocacy. A lot of humanitarian actors are beating the drum about the funding shortfall across the board. There have been, at least in the U.S., a number of hearings in committees and subcommittees on Capitol Hill to really draw attention to the plight in these four countries. And remarkably, I've seen, certainly not at the beginning of the crisis, but more and more lately, I've been seeing more discussion among policymakers around the protection risks. And I think that's in large part due to a lot of the advocacy that's been going on in Washington with the humanitarian actors. But I think in addition to funding, it's also we need to have governments and parties to these conflicts respecting international humanitarian law. And in many of these contexts, there's not sufficient access for humanitarians to reach the populations in need. And there's also deliberate targeting of civilians and politicization of aid that's really hampering humanitarian access to get in. And even when there is funding to get into the populations in need. And I think most importantly, we really need to have donors and humanitarian actors really speaking more loudly about these direct links between food insecurity and protection concerns, particularly for women and girls. So being more vocal about that, raising more alarm bells, being more out there in the media and on Capitol Hill talking about these issues. But it's also about, at the end of the day, the funding that humanitarians take in, making sure that we're also doing our due diligence and prioritizing protection concerns along with food and nutrition and water and sanitation and health. But it's not just up to the donors, but it's also up to us as humanitarian actors to make sure that we're doing right by the populations and at addressing the needs that we see from the ground up.
If someone wants to learn more about what's going on with the famine or wants to learn about what they could do, could you point them anywhere?
There's a website. InterAction is an umbrella organization of NGOs that has a famine response page. Certainly, there are UN response bulletins and updates that can be accessed online as well. I'd also like to direct folks to IRC's website, rescue.org, and you can search. We have pages there that are dedicated to the famine situation in the four countries, and in particular have done a series of videos that break down the famine and what does famine mean and how many people are impacted and what the definitions are. And all of that information can also be found on rescue.org.
Great. Thanks, both. Programming during the famine and in food insecurity, the funds allocated and the policies surrounding that can't continue to be gender blind. This exacerbates the negative consequences on women and girls and raises the likelihood of sexual exploitation and abuse. There's an urgency to this action that can't be ignored. So thanks for joining us, Patty and Janine, and thanks for listening. Safety, voice, respect. Join the WPE movement.